Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And today on the show,
history.
History.
Culture.
Total cultural landscape history, to be sure. Charles Birnbaum.
Yeah, Charles is the director and founder of an organization called the Cultural Landscape Foundation, which works on a nationwide basis to kind of find places in danger of being torn down, ripped down, falling apart, and preserving them. And it's a network of, it's an educational group, it's a really philanthropic group, a network of different organizations that care about those things. And it's very important that we do that.
Yeah, they really try to, I guess, raise awareness about these places and what their cultural relevance is to Americans, you know, in that place or otherwise. And that's sort of the selling point, the whole notion of a cultural landscape, you know, making it relevant, I guess.
Yeah, just think Olmsted Park in Louisville.
Yeah, it's
that's exactly what they do, you know, they're aware of and try and preserve those legacies that are so important to us all.
Exactly. So we'll be talking to him. And then we're also going to talk to, which I think also this relates, because the DuPonts, I guess they were able to do it themselves if they didn't blow up.
they had the money.
But Maggie Litz is joining us. She's the author of a new book called The DuPonts, Houses and Gardens and the Brandywine. And Maggie's at Winterthur Estate. She's the historian there. And, you know, just talking about architecture, landscape architecture, this sort of communal experience that many of the DuPonts had in that Brandywine Valley, which is Delaware and Pennsylvania.
Right.
Another famous garden, of course, is Longwood. But there's, you know, other significant places that represent that DuPont legacy. It was interesting, Bob. By 1926, they were really starting to make money. The company was. They started in TNT, you know, like gunpowder TNT. Then by like 1926 through the 40s, they were making like neoprene and other types of, you know, plastics. But I didn't know this. They controlled GM and U.S. Steel and big companies like that at that point. I had no idea.
They had a huge presence in Louisville.
Huge, yeah. There was a DuPont company here, too.
In that area, that Brandywine Valley, we've both been there. And if you're a gardener and haven't been to Winterthur or Longwood or Chanticleer, any of those Philadelphia area gardens, you just have to go. They're awe-inspiring and... You know, you get ideas, no matter how big they are, you can see something you can bring back with you.
They really are. They're fabulous.
Just incredible
stuff. Really are. It's totally worth it. Absolutely. Yeah. So, yes, that's coming up today on Homegrown. We hope that you'll stick with us. What's going on in your garden, Bob?
Well, I broke my spring fever. There was a warm spell a couple weeks ago. Remember, it had been cold for so long? And I had to see some green. So I went out, and I do have some greenhouses, so I'm kind of cheating, but... My little columbines were coming up.
Are they really in the green?
I was so excited. Man, to see the little green tufts of leaves coming up.
And kind of poking through.
And the hellebores are getting ready to pop. And the witch hazel, of course, is just getting ready to bloom. And my pansies, I kept some over from last year in the greenhouse. And I went in there, there's little purple and yellow flowers. And man, did I need that. So I recommend anybody, if you can get any kind of early blooming plant in your garden, plant it in the fall and, boy, enjoy it because it just... makes life so much easier.
It really does. That little, like, extra early spring
it's hope.
Counts this time of the year, doesn't it?
Oh, I guess. How about the Wishes State? What's going on?
Well, I always know that spring's starting to get a little bit closer, Bob, when the egg production starts to go, you know, on the rise. Because as the days are shorter, their laying decreases. And now that our days are getting longer again, it's such a fabulous marker. It really is. Do you know what I mean? You know the days are getting longer because they start to roost a little
just
bit later.
Like columbines.
Roost a little bit later. And you go out there and you've got five eggs instead of one or two or three or nothing. So
do they look proud of themselves?
No.
Happier?
I don't think so, actually.
They're not doing it for you?
It's sort of just regular operating, you know, business for them.
Janine's coming. We've got some more eggs.
But I haven't seen any green eggs for a long time, so I know my Araucanas aren't laying, but everybody else is. So.
Well, they're waiting for St. Patrick's Day.
Maybe. You know what? That'll be an interesting thing if that's indeed what happens. I'll keep you posted on the green eggs. Keep you posted on the green eggs. All right, calendar. Just, you know, honestly, if you are interested in a Philadelphia trip, the Philadelphia Flower Show is coming up. It's Sunday, February 28th through Sunday, March 7th. And of course, it isn't a big indoor, you know, convention center event. It's pretty fabulous. Maybe not the ideal time to see some of these gardens, but certainly not, not worth passing up.
Oh, no, there's a lot to see.
Yeah,
there
really
too.
Is. Yeah. So, you know, you can store that in the back of your mind, maybe for something to do later in the month. And then every Wednesday during the month of February, the Garden Geeks series with Paul Capiello out at UDEL takes place. It's from 6:30 to 8:30. So check our website or UDEL's website for more information on that.
Yeah, and speaking of Philadelphia and historical things and historical gardens, preserving our culture is mm-hmm. really important in gardens as well as other things. And we've got a guest today who can talk all about that. He's Charles Birnbaum. He's founder and director of the Cultural Landscape Foundation, the only not-for-profit foundation in America dedicated to increasing the public's awareness and understanding of the importance and irreplaceability, really, of our cultural landscapes. So, Charles, welcome to Homegrown.
Well, thank you, Bob.
Let's begin with some background first. I'm always curious about people, how they got involved and what they're doing. So kind of catch me up on Charles Birnbaum and how you got...
Well, I'm born and raised in New York City, and if I get drunk, you can hear the accent.
My southern accent's the same.
My love of landscape probably came from not having enough of it. I grew up in Queens, New York, sort of typical suburban post-war community, about 25 minutes from Manhattan on the railroad. And my love of landscape goes back to my childhood in particular, and actually to New London, Connecticut, and being in my grandparents' garden. And my grandmother was a wonderful gardener. And my first brush with landscape archaeology happened in that garden when I unearthed an old Moxie Pop bottle,
which
I still have with cut flowers to this day in my kitchen.
Wow.
And that's kind of where it all started.
Wow.
So then... what led you to founding the Cultural Landscape Foundation? How'd that happen?
Well, I'm trained as a landscape architect, and I worked in New York City for about 11 years, and then I went to the big bad federal government, where I spent 16 wonderful years setting national policy. And it was really during that time, dealing with historic and cultural landscapes where, you know, basically the government would say, you can do this, you can't do this, mm-hmm. trying to offer assistance. And I realized, wait a minute, guys, you know, America's favorite hobbies are gardening and golf. And
right.
And that's, you know, the reality is we should not be looking at what they've done in the architecture world, which is top down. I mean, we're talking about bottom up, grassroots.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're already at an advantage because everyone loves landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I really wanted to do as a product of environmental education, I'm 49, so I grew up in the bees and bunnies culture. Taught my parents about recycling and came home like a lot of kids with my cut-down milk carton in my avocado pit or my potato to grow. And but, you know, I'm also a product of art education, which has been diminished in this country for the last several decades. And so my quest was to reunite nature and culture and do it for free and do it online using new technologies, which everyone is up for.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started the Cultural Landscape Foundation in 1998 while I was a Loeb Fellow at Harvard's Graduate School of Design, and taking advantage of the robust offerings of the Kennedy School of Government and other resources at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And we were founded that year, and we had our first board meeting that November, 1998.
Mm-hmm. So was there one particular or a handful of places even that kind of fueled your desire with the Cultural Landscapes Foundation, or was it just that overall experience?
One of the things that I experienced, having at this point worked in the public sector in New York City on important landscapes all across the country, from Prospect Park in Brooklyn to Lake Washington Boulevard in Seattle and Boston's Emerald Necklace Parks, is that what we were seeing happen, I think, in the U.S. is you had the people who were the big star architects, as they like to call them, the big star designers,
yeah, right.
And then we had the preservation people who were still viewed as the lady with tennis sneakers from the old garden club days, and God bless them. That's why we have so many wonderful places that still exist.
Mm-hmm.
But there was, again, this divide, this sort of siloization of things. And I saw this in the work, and then what I also came to realize is that, for example, in Louisville, Kentucky, it's like to understand the Louisville parks, it's like you can go there and say, yes, I think Cherokee Park is wonderful, or Iroquois Park is a great mountain landscape, but one needs to think about landscapes like Russian nesting dolls. How do they fit together?
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise,
right.
How do you understand how to guide change? I mean, you know, let's face it, people like Rembrandt or Picasso did a lot of paintings, but only a handful of those are masterpieces. Now, in the case of Louisville, It's one of only two American cities where all three Olmsteds worked. Iroquois Park is one of only two mountain landscapes, with Mount Royal and Montreal being the other. So when you start to understand how these places fit together like a big mosaic, then you can guide change. The problem we had is people didn't want to pay for the research. And so that's kind of the reason I started the foundation, was to instill value for people to then be able to celebrate landscapes from the most humble to the most majestic.
Mm-hmm. So when you embark on this sort of thing, you have to sort of clearly define what your mission is and clearly define, you know, what a cultural landscape is. So can we talk about that so people can have an idea of the different sorts of places that you're looking at? You know, what is a cultural landscape?
Sure. First of all, the entire country is a cultural landscape. Every landscape that is shaped by humankind that reflects that cultural tradition is a cultural landscape. Now, the way to define them is the Park Service, and I agree with these definitions. They're really the easiest to wrap your hands around, and none of these are mutually exclusive. So, for example, a cultural landscape could be a design landscape like a great Olmsted Park.
Mm-hmm.
A cultural landscape could be a vernacular landscape like a great Kentucky horse farm. And then it could also be part of an ongoing traditional practice,
mm-hmm.
which means, for example, like Amish people or Native Americans, where you may have vernacular expressions, but they're part of a continuing culture.
Sort of openly and notoriously used and appreciated in some sort of fashion over time.
Right. And mm-hmm. the only difference between a historic, and then the last one is a historic site, might be a battlefield, the site of a president's home,
mm-hmm.
those sorts of things. So all four of those types, with cultural landscapes being the umbrella term. So you have designed, mm-hmm. vernacular, historic sites, and then the ones with traditional cultural practices are called ethnographic landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not mutually exclusive. If you look at a place like the Blue Ridge Parkway, I would suggest that you have all four types of landscapes present in the Blue Ridge Parkway. And what the Blue Ridge Parkway did is it knit all of those places of scenic and historic and cultural significance together
mm-hmm.
through a road.
Well, Charles, let's talk then about, kind of focus us down a little bit on what success stories you've had, some projects around the country you've worked with and on that have been able to preserve the culture and the landscape.
Well, I think that there's a variety of projects that we've been involved in. First, if we look at success being just getting people to see places, I would say, for example, in Louisville, there was we worked with Riverfields, the second oldest river conservation group in the U.S., founded in 1959. For the second largest river, the Ohio River, pardon me. And we got people to realize that the country place estates, if you will, along River Road, were like a textbook of who's who in the profession of landscape architecture. So one success might be getting people to see something they didn't see before. So very often we might be involved in something where, even if we may not win the battle, if something's threatened with being bulldozed, we also want to honor that landscape with a discourse, so that there is informed discussion that happens to guide change.
Mm-hmm.
We just found out yesterday, I'm excited to say, that a landscape that we were very much involved with last year in Springfield, Missouri, that was designed by Lawrence Halprin, who designed the FDR Memorial,
mm-hmm.
one of the great landscape architects of the post-war world, who passed away this past October at the age of 93. It was going to be demolished, and we partnered with the National Trust and some other folks to raise awareness, and I just found out that the what's called the Keeper of the National Register had signed off on the designation of that landscape just this past week. So that landscape will now be part of a historic district, which will afford it some level of protection. And that was a landscape that was very much looking like it was going to be lost.
So, Charles, because you guys aren't necessarily doing the preservation work, if you will, but rather providing certain resources to allow people to sort of lobby for the preservation of these places. Is that correct? And, you know, what kind of information or awareness, education mm-hmm. could be an example of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the things that we have is a program called Landslide, where we try to put a spotlight on a landscape that may be endangered. Beginning, for example, in 2003, there was another Lawrence Halprin landscape that was endangered in Fort Worth, Texas, and it's called Heritage Park, and it was one of the projects that he did for the bicentennial. And this project for the last several years has had a chain link fence around it, and it too was going to be destroyed. And so we begin by posting a website. Then in 2008, we did our annual themed list of endangered landscapes, mm-hmm. and it was called Marvels of Modernism. And we partnered actually with the George Eastman Museum, who hired regional photographers to actually photograph these endangered modern landscapes as a way to get people to see them differently, to look at the photographs through the eyes of other artists, but also to teach people, in this case, about what makes a landscape modern. And again, this was a landscape that was on a slippery slope. And now what's happened in Texas is that the very celebrated philanthropist Ruth Carter Stevenson is now spearheading an effort to bring the landscape back. She's made a charitable contribution herself. And the Texas Historical Commission, which is the state nonprofit, has also now prepared a National Register nomination, which is forthcoming to Washington. So what we see happening are things at the grassroots level, where, like in Fort Worth, Texas, the local city paper wrote all these articles, and people started to discover, wait a minute, the same guy that designed the FDR Memorial mm-hmm. and worked at Yosemite and worked with George Lucas at his studios had done this project in Fort Worth. And I think what happens very often is when a landscape falls into disrepair, people may not, especially a public landscape, people don't feel safe, and they start to want to see it change without really asking the right questions. Mm-hmm. And so I think, to me, what is so exciting is when you start to reveal these stories of a landscape that have been forgotten, swept under the rug, and then you have this sort of recognition that happens, and people start bringing photographs out of their family photo albums, and there's a genesis to actually bring it back. And I think more and more that's happening at a grassroots level across the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, Charles, can a landscape be like one house in a small yard as well as 5,000 acres? And then how do people contact you about these particular situations?
Well, and people do contact us at all scales that you could imagine. You know, one of the examples, I mean, if we wanted to be a little controversial today, I was telling one of my board members last night, I don't know how many people are following what's happening right now in Nantucket about this wind farm that's proposed for offshore. Well, on one end of the spectrum, that's pretty monumental, I would say. And when I look at that at the big scale, I say, you know, you think, well, what's important? And Calvert Vaux, for example, who was Olmsted's partner on Central Park, wrote an essay in 1880 called The Value of Sky and Skyline. And, you know, part of what makes it important as a borrowed view is that uninterrupted line. And, of course, for Native Americans, it's of great cultural significance. So, on one hand, you could look at something at a big scale. The other thing you could look at a very small scale is you could look at the vegetable garden that the White House has planted, and I think this is a great message to make, on their front lawn. Mm-hmm. But the question I would ask is, was the front lawn the best location for the garden? That it sends a message politically, I think it's a worthy message, just like right now the administration is trying to send a message that we have to reach a compromise about wind, that wind is critical, and I would agree with that. But the question becomes, and it's no different in your neighborhood park when someone says, hey, look at this, wonderful Mr. John Smith is giving money to the community to build a new playground. And the question becomes, where does it go? And very often we see what I call plop and drop, where something is looked at in a vacuum without understanding the visual and spatial relationships. Now, just to be, you know, provocative here, I would actually say, if no one's playing tennis at the White House anymore, maybe we should have ripped up the tennis court and planted the vegetable garden within that footprint without putting it in a place where it's a historic visual and spatial relationship. Mm-hmm. And so I think very often we all ask these questions. It's like if I live in a little house and it's in a historic community, you know, I think very often that what you put in your front yard when you're part of what I call, if it's a planned community, what I refer to as a common symphonic language, you might put certain things in the front and certain things in the back, but when you're in the front of the house, you want to be part of what makes the place special.
Mm-hmm. So are there places, in fact, that are ugly industrial sites that could, in fact, be considered cultural landscapes?
Well, in historic preservation, for buildings, for landscapes, the term that's used is authenticity.
Okay.
Oh. And so and this is a very interesting thing, I think, because very often we all know what we like or what we don't like.
Sure.
And we all are always usually pretty happy to give our opinion about that.
Right.
But the question becomes very often to understand also what is real. And what a lot of times people don't know, that especially if you're dealing with public places, that people will often pay to see what is real. The Smithsonian, for example, did a survey a couple of years ago at all 14 of their museums, and they asked visitors, what's the most important thing when you go to the Smithsonian? And the number one rated thing, more than family and friends and feeling a sense of pride in America, number one by over 60%, was to see the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think very often what happens in this age of pastiche, where people open catalogs mm-hmm. and drop down gazebos and, you know, historical-looking benches and hanging baskets, that very often people don't realize that we have to teach people what's real to understand that design intent. So, you know, the issue of places that are not traditionally beautiful, I think have always been of interest to people. I think about these postcards that I have, many postcards of mining sites, for example, which, of course, you know, mining sites can do a lot of environmental degradation. But when you look back at these postcards, there was even a fascination then, even from sort of the perspective of a tourist, to see a mining site. We're now looking at a lot of post-war industrial sites and things that have to deal with nuclear issues that are now reaching 50 years of age and are National Register candidates. So I think that, you know, the landscapes are embedded with stories, and I think our challenge is to figure out how to tell those stories and to understand how they have resonance, if you will, for people that are living out 21st century life. So mm-hmm. the long answer, I guess, to your question is a landscape does not have to be beautiful.
Yeah.
And I also
relevance.
Think that there are things like, I mean, walking around there are ranches, for example, in Point Reyes, California, that, you know, for me, part of that experience is the smells, you know, and what happens if you're just preserving buildings and you don't have those brushy cows on those ranch lands, then it's a very different experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to see Archie Bunker's chair at the Smithsonian. Does that qualify, you think?
I would say absolutely. I don't get to sit on it.
I really did. Of all the wonderful things to see, and we did, of course, but Archie Bunker's chair was relevant to me.
Well, I'm a big fan of Julia Child's Kitchen.
Well, you know, we were just there, and Julia Child's Kitchen, we did want to see that, and it was roped off and closed because they were still, like, redoing some of it, so
oh,
we
my.
Got to look around the door, but that was about it.
Well, Charles, can you give us a sense in the, 10, 12 years you've been doing this now, how many different projects you've worked on and, say, saved, if that's the word to use?
I would say, first and foremost, the thing that we're really doing is, at a macro scale, we're changing the way people look at the American landscape. Our website will have 20,000 visitors a day. We'll
wow.
do 6 million hits this year. It has truly been an if you build it, they will come.
Right.
And I should mention our website is TCLF, for the first letters of the Cultural Landscape Foundation, .org. And so on one hand, that's, you know, that's one way that we are reaching people and we're instilling value. And I think all of us think about our childhood, and I told you my Moxie Pop bottle and story, and I think that for a lot of young people that are web savvy, which are most kids today, they're having those explorations online, mm-hmm. and hopefully some of those experiences are resonating. In terms of landscapes that we've saved, I'd be hard to put a number on it, but I would say, and because these things like Heritage Park, for example, we've been involved since 2003, very often these things don't happen overnight. But I would say in my tenure of having been at this, in the private sector, the public sector, and now the nonprofit center, there's probably several hundred landscapes that I could point to that have been brought back. But the reality is, you know, our work is just the beginning. When these landscapes are brought back, they're brought back because the people in the community care. And whether it's an individual homeowner that says, like a friend of mine now who's in Duluth, Minnesota, who bought a house and made this discovery that her landscape was designed by these Minnesota landscape architects, Morella Nichols, and she said, I'm going to restore it, and she had the resources to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, places like Central Park and Prospect Park, I mean, I worked on Prospect Park in the 80s, and it took 25 years to build that park, and it's going to take 25 years to put it back together again.
If not more, huh?
Right. And so these things don't happen overnight. But I think for me, it's really about getting people to have what I refer to as a shared value system,
mm-hmm.
so that we value equally nature, scenery, and culture.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Charles.
Yeah, terrific.
Thank you both.
We'll keep watching the work that you're all doing. And
great.
Try
and please tell your visitors that they can sign up for our monthly communications free of charge.
All right,
great.
Sure will.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Charles.
Sure,
bye
now.
Charles Birnbaum is the founder and director of the Cultural Landscape Foundation. He spoke to us from his office in New York City. For more information on Charles or the foundation, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up after the break, Maggie Litz and the DuPonts in the Brandywine Valley. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
With Bob Hill.
And kind of continuing in that theme of shared values, I think, Bob.
Yeah.
There's a great new book out. It's called The DuPonts, Houses and Gardens of the Brandywine, and it's by Maggie Litz. And Maggie is basically entrenched in Winchester.
With reason.
But she works there, but has gone beyond to the other homes that the DuPonts had. And interesting, I mean, really just so many different little interesting tidbits about the family. By 1942, Bob, there were 70 country homes in the Brandywine of 20 acres or more.
Oh, I believe it.
You know, I mean, just... Yeah. That were part of the family.
I think what's really sad about modern America is this doesn't happen anymore. People don't share their wealth.
Mm-hmm.
They buy yachts and build monuments in Dubai and they leave town, but they don't build these gardens and places for the public enjoyment that we need.
Yeah, and like
Louisville.
Being connected to a place, too.
Right.
So it's a beautiful book, but a fascinating book, too. I think Americans have always been fascinated with families like the DuPonts. But Maggie Litz is joining us now. She is the estate historian for Winchester Museum, a DuPont family estate that dates back to 1839. The estate is well known for its collection of American decorative arts and its horticultural histories. Maggie has published several books on the family, including Life at Winchester, a DuPont family album, and, of course, most recently, The DuPonts, Houses and Gardens in the Brandywine, both published by Acanthus Press. Maggie, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Sure. Listen, you started all of this, really, as a graduate student at the University of Delaware.
That's right.
I think architecture, right?
So yes.
What was so appealing about the DuPonts and all of their homes?
Well, it's the fact that there were so many that settled in one area,
mm-hmm.
and that they had money. And what money gives people is choice. And what I found really interesting about the DuPonts is that they created a community here. They had enough money to make choices in their architecture that could really illustrate this kind of communal values that they had.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see those over a long period of time. They're also great savers. So there was lots and lots of documentation.
Uh-huh. And, okay, let's elaborate a little bit on this notion of communal values,
mm-hmm.
and like the value and the shared values that they had relating to the importance of land and all that, because it's something that you mention in the book as being, I guess, one of the most remarkable things about the family. So how was that, I guess, actualized, this notion of shared values?
I think it's important to look at the history of this, and
mm-hmm.
what happened in the 19th century is really important. The family came over from France in 1800, and they practiced a kind of communalism. They had a gunpowder mill at Brandywine River. It was far from the population center of Wilmington at that time, a couple miles out. They had this little isolated community, and the isolation was because the business they were in was dangerous. It was gunpowder making,
mm-hmm.
and they blew up fairly regularly.
Wow.
And the family believed that they should share in the danger as much as the workers.
Okay.
The family houses and the workers' houses were very close to the mills. And in order that no one person had to had to be responsible for an accident when the mills blew up, which they did, and no one had to bear the financial responsibility of that, the company owned all the houses and the horses and the carriages.
Uh-huh.
The family individual members did not. The company owned
it. The company owned it, okay.
Oh. Isn't that interesting?
It is
interesting. And very unusual in the United States.
Sure.
And it didn't go on for 10 years. It went on from 1802 to 1902.
Wow.
It was 100 years.
Now, there was a Louisville connection to this, too. Talk about that, the Kentucky connection to the DuPonts.
There was a group of DuPonts who came down to, went down to Kentucky. They started the DuPont, offshoot of the DuPont company down there.
Mm-hmm.
And there, they stayed for a couple generations. In fact, T. Coleman DuPont, who was one of the founders of the reorganized company in 1902, was born in Kentucky.
Okay.
And Coleman was one of the three cousins who came back to the Brandywine and bought out their family company. And they were the ones that really made the company money in the 20th century. What I found most interesting was that the first thing they did when they made their money, those three cousins bought country estates and created them.
So, okay, we'll talk. I mean, I hate to always highlight the homes and gardens that everybody knows, but, you know, we should address Longwood and Winterthur as two very significant DuPont family places. But before we get to that, you know, we've touched on the horticultural connection, but there's also a significant agricultural connection. I was surprised to learn that some breeding by the DuPonts at Winterthur resulted in the Holstein cow.
Well,
or
not quite.
An improved version, I should say.
Improved version.
So agriculture and experimentation took place at Winterthur in a pretty significant way, but also for practical reasons, right?
Yes.
Because if you're isolated in the compound, so to speak, you need to be able to support yourself.
Right. Well, you know, the thing about the why I find architecture so interesting is you can really tell the history of a whole era through the kind of these physical objects people are creating to live in, right? So what's interesting about the DuPonts and their estates here in the Brandywine is the 19th century, they didn't have that much money. But what happens in the 20th century is they create the landscape that we're all living in today. It's really a 20th century phenomenon when the family really got money and started creating these enormous properties that were not just about a big house and not just about the garden, but about agriculture and land.
Sustainability, I guess.
And sustainability, and they were part of a whole era called the country place era that happened really in the United States from after the Civil War right through World War II. In fact, here in Wilmington, the 1930s, there was a huge spike of creation of country estates. And
after the to everybody else's in the midst of the Depression.
Not everybody. I mean, that maybe the 1930s is so interesting because we've all created, we all know what the 1930s looks like today because of those fantastic photographs that we're familiar with. But look at the movies from that era and look at the architecture. Some of the most luxurious objects ever created in the 20th century came out of the 1930s. The Queen Mary, for example, some of the best cars of the 20th century came out during the 1930s. It was an era not just of poverty, but of enormous wealth. Those who kept their money had more money than they ever had.
Can you give us a sense, Maggie, of the size of the staffs and the gardening staffs in some of these places?
Yeah, I can tell you a lot about Winterthur in that way, but it's a little bit of an exception to the rest of the DuPonts. I don't think most of them lived as grandly as Winterthur. But H.F. DuPont had about 250 people who lived and worked here on the property.
Ooh.
There were 90 workers' houses. In the early 1930s, there were 34 people who worked full-time in the house. And you know, if you put that in perspective of the Depression, it was a great place for people to work.
Sure.
I mean, people were banging on the doors trying to work at these country places because you had a there was an economic solidity here. You could always get food. You weren't as dependent on the vagaries of the really shaky economic markets at that point.
Well, who designed these great gardens? Did they bring people from Europe, or did they do it themselves?
Mostly Americans. In fact, there was a whole group of, interestingly enough, a whole group of American women were doing them. Ellen Biddle Shipman, Marion Coffin. There was a group of men that we don't know as much about because there hasn't been as much work done on them recently, but Noel Chamberlain was very prominent in that time period, and he did some of the, laid out the estates. I mean, if you want to buy a place, say you suddenly acquire, as some of the DuPonts did say in the late 1920s, say you acquire 500 acres, you want to put a house there, you want to put a garden, you want to put greenhouses, you want to put a farm, how do you lay that out? So you hire somebody like Noel Chamberlain to say, here's where you want to put your greenhouse. Mm-hmm. Here's where you want to put your cow barn. Here's where you want to put your garages. Laid out the path system, the road system. Winterthur had, I think, almost 11 miles of paved roads. And having paved roads was a sign of being a careful gentleman. Mm-hmm. You know, it was part of your gentleman attributes to have a well-taken care of estate.
Were these totally private? Could the public see any of these gardens at all?
They had fairly regular open garden days, mm-hmm. And if you were a member of any of the garden clubs, you could go to them. It's actually pretty accessible, and you could come and visit the gardens a couple days during the year. There were maps where all the houses were located that were given out by the garden clubs, and sometimes, you know, even if it wasn't officially open, they would give you the contact numbers. If you want to visit, you could do that.
Yeah.
Longwood, which is the most popular garden that we have here today, I mean, this area is just filled with mm-hmm. public gardens today, mm-hmm. but Longwood is the most popular, and that was open, I think, mostly on Sundays, a couple Sundays a month, but we have photographs from the 1920s of traffic jams outside Longwood of all the people coming to visit.
Well, so did some of this relate to, in terms of the boom in popularity and visitors, did some of this relate to that 1929 Garden Club of America tour and all the publicity that surrounded that?
Yeah, well, in the 1920s, this area became increasingly well-known for gardens.
Mm-hmm.
Charles Sargent wrote in Horticultural Magazine in 1924 that the DuPont family in the last four generations had made the neighborhood of Wilmington one of the chief centers of horticulture in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And that reputation kept growing. And you just mentioned that visit. I found it amazing in 1929 that 1,200 people came to visit Wilmington on a very well-publicized tour. You see a lot about it in newspapers.
Hmm.
They came in busloads to visit all of these gardens, about 14 gardens they visited mm-hmm. that day.
So when we look at the properties today,
mm-hmm.
some of them are in private hands, some
right.
of them have been demolished or
right.
blown or fell down because they
blew up.
blew up, right?
One too many explosions, right? I mean, and that, we laugh, but it's true.
It's
dear,
true.
Dear listeners. But they're, you know, Longwood and Winterthur certainly the most famous, but there are other homes like the Owl's Nest, which is just a fabulous place. That's a country club now, I think, and
yes.
some are libraries.
There's
and some
Nemours,
are, yeah, Nemours.
Which is today the Alfred I. DuPont Center for Children's Healthcare.
Okay.
And it is one of the largest children's healthcare facilities in the country. And then they have tours of A.I. DuPont house there, which was a Carrere and Hastings mm-hmm. mansion. I mean, mm-hmm. quite extraordinary, with an amazing garden. And then there were smaller places. There's Gibraltar, which was Isabella DuPont and her husband H. Rodney Sharp's place. That was a Marion Coffin designed garden that today is open to the public free. There are a couple parks that were DuPont family owned. There's the Valley Garden Park, which was once T. Coleman, again, the one from Kentucky,
mm-hmm.
He and his wife had an amazing place called the Old Mill. They donated their property to the city in 1929 for a much-needed reservoir.
Mm-hmm.
So most of their land was flooded, but they preserved part of the garden and removed part of the garden plantings and set them off that reservoir site. So that's Valley Garden today.
Mm-hmm. Bellevue's a state park as well?
It's a city-owned park.
City-owned park.
County park. County owned.
And people have heard of Mount Cuba, which is
Mount Cuba,
was
an
a DuPont
extraordinary
property.
Place.
Now, Research Center. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So
it's
so,
an incredible legacy.
It is an incredible legacy. So, if visitors are going to come to the Brandywine area and visit some of these places,
mm-hmm.
what kind of experience are they going to have? You know, the Philadelphia Flower Show is coming up pretty soon. So, people are heading up that way, they definitely want to hit some of these places
right.
For a full experience.
Well, you know, make an appointment at Nemours, which I think is a no-fail amazing experience for people. You do have to make an appointment to get there, but they have just renovated their garden and their house. The house has will give you a real sense of how millionaires in the early part of the 20th century lived. It still has its sauna rooms and bowling alleys and kitchens intact. I think driving from, say, Nemours to Hagley, which is another museum, it's where the DuPont Company mills were located. It was where Louise DuPont Crowninshield's house was. Just driving around this area, you'll see that Brandywine landscape that Andrew Wyeth was so romanticized in his paintings, or maybe not romanticized, illustrated in his paintings. It's still intact in this area, and just driving around and looking at it as you go between the Moors, Hagley, Winterthur, Valley Garden Park, or Longwood. An outgrowth of this book, because I was so impressed with the gardens and I had such a hard time putting everything I needed to in the book, I've got an exhibition that opens March 27th here at Winterthur on the gardens here in the Brandywine Valley.
Great.
Not just the DuPont garden, but a lot of other family gardens that were in this area. And I talk about the dynamic between the families, the workers, the designers, and also the club, who were so important in being an audience for these gardens. There are about 100, more than 100 color photographs I've got of the gardens in the 1920s that are from the Hagley Museum that were done by William Spruance in the 1920s that we'll be showing through sort of in an endless loop in this exhibition that I think are just extraordinary.
That sounds great.
So in terms of the gardens, just one more question, Maggie.
Yeah.
In terms of the gardens, how many of them have maintained their integrity over the years, and how many of them have been lost, sadly?
Well, it's funny. That's one of the main things that I have been thinking about for this exhibition. You know, it's the struggle for historic gardens, what integrity means. Gardens have to change over time.
Right.
The Winterthur garden in the 1920s is quite different than it is today. That's very true. That's even more true, I think, at Longwood, Nemours. It may be a little less true. I mean, Nemours is a really very architectural garden that they just renovated really back to the 1930s, and they've done a fantastic job. Winterthur has one of the last remaining wild gardens in the world, and that's a garden that's not wilderness, but it's planted with mostly Asian bulbs and plants to heighten the natural look of the Brandywine, and extend the bloom season, but planted as if they've grown naturally. So if you come here, what you'll see are 5 acres of blue blooming bulbs at the end of May, for example, in our March bank, or 8 acres of azaleas blooming along with the dogwoods and the wildflowers in our azalea garden.
I've seen that. I was just inspiring beyond. I just sat down on the bench and almost cried.
And wept.
Just unbelievable.
It is really beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great. It really is a great garden. It's one of America's great gardens here at Winterthur.
Oh,
I feel really proud to work here.
Well, we certainly appreciate the work that you're doing, Maggie. And the book is, in fact, a beautiful book. I'll continue to enjoy it as I try to learn keep all those DuPont names straight.
Very hard. I can't even do it.
Thank you for your time.
You.
We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Maggie Litz is the estate historian for Winterthur Museum and the author of The DuPonts, Houses and Gardens in the Brandywine, published by Acanthus Press. Of course, for more information on Winterthur, the book, or the other DuPont gardens and houses, please visit our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and another chapter in Bob's Fabulous Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Well, Miss Wishy, we're back and pretty historically stuffed, I would say.
I'd say so. It's all very interesting, though, isn't it?
Oh, it is, yeah.
Yeah, and you got to know a little bit more about the things you're experiencing than just that visual, huh?
Or we are doomed to repeat it.
Exactly.
I guarantee it. Meanwhile, we've got a question for you.
All right.
It's from a retired University of Kentucky basketball coach named Joe B.
It may or may not be, right?
He needs something to do here. It could be Joe B. Who knows?
It could be.
Anyway, He wants to grow some Honeycrisp apple trees on a plot of property in southern Indiana. No, it's not Joe.
No, exactly.
Research indicates I will need a pollinator tree to help with the growth and production of the Honeycrisp apples.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give me an idea of the indigenous pollinator trees that I could use? One's found here locally. Thanks, Joby.
So, okay, indigenous pollinator trees. Yes and no. If you want to grow Honeycrisp successfully,
okay,
the key to any sort of most fruit production is going to be a good cross-pollination effect in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
And apples are, different types of apple varieties are, some are like early season, mid-season, mid to late season. And if my memory serves me, the Honeycrisp is sort of a mid to late season bloomer, right? So you're going to want a comparable cross pollinator that's blooming a little bit, mid to late season.
Same time.
At the same time. So in terms of indigenous, I'm not really sure. Certain types of crab apples that are going to bloom at the same time might help.
Yeah.
But I think that if you're going to go and you're going to grow a Honeycrisp tree for the fruit, go all the way. Right? Don't you think?
Yes, ma'am. I love
it. And get the appropriate pollinator for it. And then you'll get, good fruit off of the other tree as well.
So just check with a local expert.
So wherever you buy your Honeycrisp, you will also be provided with information of appropriate pollinators. And you really should go ahead and invest in that appropriate pollinator as well.
And
there will be a list of, different trees that would adequately do it. But the key is to look for that, mid to late season bloomer, because that's going to be the comparable pollinator.
I gotcha.
Cross pollinator. How about that?
Yes, ma'am.
And don't kill your bees because you need them to do it too.
If you have a pollinator question for Bob or Janine, ask Dr. Ruth or visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Or email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 502-814-8246.
All right, Bob, it's Plant Story Day. What do you have?
This one is for Maggie Lids.
All right. That's awfully nice.
I know that. And I just love this plant anyway, so it worked out so well.
Oh, great.
Several years ago, I was at a place in Delaware called
Winterthur.
I was laying on a bench looking up directly into a handkerchief tree.
Uh-huh.
Or the dove tree.
The dove tree, yes.
It's an incredible tree. It's got these button-like stamens, but it's surrounded by these white bracts that are 3 to 6 inches long, and they flutter like white flowers.
Yeah,
so we call it the handkerchief tree.
They look like little handkerchiefs.
It's just incredible.
Or it got TP'd.
it's like, to me, it's an enduring memory, like going to grandma's house or in their garden and reaching up and touching something. You never quite get over that.
Mm-hmm.
I've never gotten over this tree. So anyway, it's in the Tupelo family. It's a native of China. It'll get maybe 30, 40 feet tall. It's hardy zone 6 to 8, but it's got to be sort of a temperate.
Mm-hmm.
Not too hot, not too cold. So you don't see it here very often. I guess nursery, it takes 15 years from seed to flower, which is part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
I can think of one in the Louisville area, but I'm going to order one. So that way I'm going to live 15 more years no matter what. Its botanical name is Davidia involucrata.
Mm-hmm.
The involucrata comes from the Latin word, which means wrapper or envelope.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that perfect?
Enveloped in,
yeah. Yeah, that's what they do. And Davidia is interesting also. It came from a French missionary to China named Father Armand David.
Mm-hmm.
He had a great interest in natural history. Went over there from France to kind of turn the natives into Catholics. And he was so good at natural history, they told him to back off a little bit and start sending back specimens.
Bring us plants.
Yeah,
never
really.
Mind.
Anybody
yeah.
can do the other stuff, yeah. But he sent back 200 species of animals, of which 63 were unknown. 807 species of birds, 65 never been described before, and 52 new species of rhododendron.
Cool.
He also did not send back the first dove tree. It was done by a plant collector named Ernest Henry Wilson, but they named it in his honor, which was nice.
That is nice.
Comes with a poem. I doubt if our big world will ever quite see a poem as lovely as the handkerchief tree, a tree to bring the strongest to tears, and that's after waiting for 15 years. For those wonderful bracts to slowly unfold all white and fluttery and lovely and bold, an absolute joy defining beauty and grace, and hidden within your grandmother's face.
Aw, that's nice. And I'm sure Maggie appreciates it.
My tribute to the dove tree.
There we go. So, yeah, you could see the dove tree if you go up there as well.
And wait 15 Sounds years good. And come to Bob's yeah. house.
Well, you could just get one that's already 15 years old. How about that?
Oy, oy, oy.
All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. We hope that you join us again for another edition next week.
Homegrown is produced by the handkerchief handy Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.